I want to talk to you about the Aztec Symposium. It takes place in Aztec, New Mexico. It'll be the 14th annual one, by the way. And it's put on by the Friends of the Library. It's a good benefit. And the interesting thing about this is it's not expensive. You can go all day on Saturday, March 26th, for only $25. And there's senior citizens discounts. And if you're a first responder or a military person, you get in free. And now they have a Friday night get-together as well and a fine, fine meal. And that's only $15. And there's a senior citizens discount there as well. Go to the website and check it all out and register. It's AztecUFO.com. AztecUFO.com. You'll find the speaker lineup and all the details. That's AztecUFO.com. That's AztecUFO.com. We're talking with Mark McCandlish, and Mark, you know, you've had quite a career in aerospace, doing project drawings and paintings, et cetera, et cetera. If you had a chance to draw, or you had an assignment to draw a picture of the craft at Aztec, what do you think it would look like?
Well, this was a classic flying saucer. In fact, the closest thing that I've seen that would resemble the appearance of this craft in terms of its general proportions, its coloration, the contours of the saucer-shaped portion of the craft. If you were to, you could probably find this on the internet, on YouTube or one of those sites that goes back and reviews old movies. But the flying saucer that these astronauts use in the film Forbidden Planet, which I believe was produced by the Disney Studios, It had almost exactly the same proportions in almost every respect as the saucer that was described and portrayed, you know, probably through model work, in that film. In fact, that was one of the things that was so surprising about that film was that, and I believe it was produced the year I was born, in 1953, starring Leslie Nielsen, who passed away recently.
Mm-hmm.
Even the access ramp that is described in Forbidden Planet on this vehicle was structured in exactly the same way as the one that the scientists found during the recovery of the Aztec crash. So you have to ask yourself if there weren't people who, even back then in the film industry, were being prepared for what a lot of us believe is a kind of acclimation of, you know, the Earth's population to the possibility that, yes, indeed, we're being visited by entities from other star systems. And that's certainly, I mean, there's just so many, I mean, the proportions of the craft, the color, the access ramp, maybe even some of the internal controls. I'd have to go back and check, but it's just so coincidental. It doesn't seem to me as though
art imitates life or life imitates art. I'm not sure. Anyway, it seems like we're being prepared for, you know, final disclosure announcements, and then nothing ever happens.
Well, you know, I think I've told you that in the course of my research into this whole area that I've encountered some really unusual things.
I understand you used to listen to late night radio and UFO shows. And it wasn't Art Bell, it was Billy Goodman.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, he had the program, I think it was called the Billy Goodman Happening.
Mark, I know Billy Goodman very well. He used to follow me on the air at KVEG in Las Vegas, AM 840.
Is that right?
I was on from 10 to midnight, and he was midnight on. I did an occasional UFO show, but basically I was in entertainment and mass appeal general subjects host. But Billy, he had quite a successful format.
Wow.
There.
Well, whatever happened to Billy? Is he still around?
Passed away.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear
had
that.
Had cancer.
Oh,
lived in Providence,
no.
Rhode Island, I believe. Oh. Yeah, we'll miss him. He was quite a talent. Yeah, Gloria Euphoria, who used to help him, she's in contact with me. She still lives in Southern California. Ted Rice, the producer of that show. At one time, Ted still lives in Las Vegas. Cosmos on YouTube. Check him out. You didn't go up to Area 51 with him, up to Groom Lake, did you? I mean, he chartered a bus, took a lot of people up there.
Well, not with Billy Goodman, but I did go up there on my own.
Yeah, Norio Hayakawa went up there with Billy Goodman one time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that. I know that Sean David Morton, who I also know, had gone up there several times and kind of caught the attention of the security people there from Wackenhut. And in fact, I found, unfortunately, that there's a very clear and obvious relationship between the county sheriff's office that kind of patrols the highways in that area and the security personnel for Area 51, because one of the other little trips that I made in my Fiero was up to where the mailbox is on that road that kind of leads down mm-hmm. to the northern gate for that complex.
Yeah, the mailbox is to nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, in fact, I didn't see any signs that said you can't go beyond this point, so I drove right down to the point where it says, you know, you can't go beyond this point, and the use of deadly force is authorized. So I got out and took some pictures of the terrain and just sort of in a souvenir kind of sense, and got back into my car, got back on the highway, and I got stopped three times by the county sheriff and written tickets every single time for going over the speed limit when I wasn't going over the speed limit. And the clear message there was, we don't like you poking the boundaries of our area over here. So there's not much you can do about something like that, and especially when you live hundreds of miles away, it's not like you can drive over there three times to make an appearance mm-hmm. and make a pleading and then come back later and fight it in court and all that kind of stuff. It's just too expensive, so you pay the bill. And that was the penalty I paid for poking around that area. But
did you find anything else while
you were
there?
I actually went there because there was a young fellow that worked at the bank that I was using at that time, who said that he'd heard these stories on the radio also, and he and some of his friends had decided to go out there and, you know, have a case of beer and kick back and, you know, sort of wait to see if they could see a UFO. And he said that they got a little bit too tipsy, and they decided they'd take off across the desert and see how close they could get to the boundary of the area before somebody came up and gave them what for. This kid said that as they were getting close to one of the boundaries, and there's not much you can do about something like that, and especially when you live hundreds of miles away, it's not like you can drive over there three times to make an appearance mm-hmm. and make a pleading and then come back later and fight it in court and all that kind of stuff. It's just too expensive, so you pay the bill. And that was the penalty I paid for poking around that area.
Did you find anything else while you were there?
Well, I actually went there because there was a young fellow that worked at the bank that I was using at that time, who said that he'd heard these stories on the radio also, and he and some of his friends had decided to go out there and, you know, have a case of beer and kick back and, you know, sort of wait to see if they could see a UFO. And he said that they got a little bit too tipsy, and they decided they'd take off across the desert and see how close they could get to the boundary of the area before somebody came up and gave them what for. And he said that they encountered a brilliant ball of light approached their vehicle at a high rate of speed, stopped, hovered not too far from their location, and, you know, they all jumped out of the car and they were looking at this thing and you know, somewhat afraid and mystified by what they were seeing, and then right as they were watching this thing, it turned transparent and disappeared.
Wow.
And to hear this young man tell a story, I mean, you could see, you know, his eyelids kind of flutter and his hands start to shake, because he'd obviously experienced something that really left an impression on him. And that was, you know, in addition to all the other stories that I'd heard about that area, it was something that motivated me to go out there and look at that. This brilliant ball of light approached their vehicle at a high rate of speed, stopped, hovered not too far from their location, and, you know, they all jumped out of the car and they were looking at this thing and, you know, somewhat afraid and mystified by what they were seeing, and then right as they were watching this thing, it turned transparent and disappeared.
Wow.
And to hear this young man tell the story, I mean, you could see, his eyelids kind of flutter and his hands start to shake because he'd obviously experienced something that really left an impression on him. And that was, in addition to all the other stories that I'd heard about that area, it was something that motivated me to go out there and
anything like that happened to you while you were around Area 51?
Not while I was there. I actually had more high strangeness after leaving the Aztec area and heading over towards Dulce.
Yeah, I want to get to Dulce because here on our page we have a picture by a cell phone from a person who lives there who has a picture of it's a flying saucer right by the mesa, right by the Archelon Mesa.
You're kidding?
No.
That's amazing.
Not kidding. So let's talk about your trip to Dulce. I think you made it up to the top of the mesa.
Well, I traveled across the northern half of New Mexico after leaving Aztec, which is it's not too far from a geographical landmark called Shiprock. It's Aztec is sort of northeast of that location. And so I proceeded east from Aztec towards the highways that would take me into an area of the I think it's called the Jicarilla Indian Reservation,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of a reservation. It's probably several hundred square miles, kind of in a long rectangle that sort of runs north and south, but it comes to within just a few miles of the town of Dulce itself. And so I had to catch a road that approached that area from the south and came up into the Dulce area. I had a friend, a fellow, a UFO researcher who was the fellow that I initially contacted after I came into this information about the alien reproduction vehicle that we've talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Paul Shepard, and he's since kind of left the whole UFO research field, but he was friends with the son of Dennis Weaver, the actor who used to play McCloud on TV.
Yeah, I know Dennis.
And Dennis Weaver had some property just over the border in Colorado, just north of where the Archuleta Mesa and Dulce is located. And he and his son, I believe his son's name was Rusty, had an awful lot of UFO sightings from what Paul Shepard had told me. And in fact, Paul Shepard was pretty good friends with Rusty. So I had done a little research in the Los Angeles office of the U.S. Geological Survey, which had topographical maps of just about every part of the United States, with the exception of Area 51. That was the one area I couldn't find any maps for. But they did have plenty of maps for the area down around Dulce, and Paul and a number of his friends had decided to mount an expedition to go down there and see whether there was anything to the story of the Archuleta Mesa and the things that were alleged to have happened in or around Dulce or beneath the mesa in some kind of an underground complex. Several of the people that Paul took with him were some researchers who had one fellow had developed a very sophisticated system, very similar to ground-penetrating radar, but it would use high-volume, multi-frequency sound broadcasts using large speakers, like the kind you would see being used on stage at some of these rock concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a number of power systems that were sort of independently driven. They could take and put a speaker on a kind of a platform and lay it on the ground, and they'd have a remote control device that would allow them to time the moment of broadcast and the frequencies that were transmitted through these speakers, which of course were pointed down towards the ground. And they would go to four different specific locations, and then they would sit right in the middle of these the placement of these four speakers. And they would broadcast these various speakers, these frequencies into the ground, and it was all being listened to by a device that they sort of embedded into the ground right in the center of where those speakers were located. And so by sending these different frequencies into the ground rather than using like a, you know, a shotgun shell or some kind of a small explosive charge to send out a pulse of sound through the geography of the, mm-hmm. of the ground, they would use sound of different frequencies. And it was almost like using an ultrasound to image a child in the womb of a pregnant individual. And so they were able to get a very clear picture of what was happening beneath the arch of La Mesa. They had these speakers that were positioned at some fairly wide distances from one another. And they came back with data that suggested very strongly that there was a complex beneath the arch of La Mesa that rivaled the size of New York City. They said that it was just an absolutely massive facility. There was no doubt about it. They could see very clear artificial structures beneath the mesa, and that the electrical systems alone, which I guess because of all the conduit and the copper wire and so forth that went from one area to another for transmission of power and telemetry and things like that, was something you would expect to see used in a city in terms of its size. Now, the only explanation I have for their being able to see these particular components is because of the perhaps the electrical resonance of these systems, probably alternating current. They had all this data. They had a Japanese television station that was coming over to review their data. They wanted to do a special program about all of this. You know, the Japanese are very intrigued by this kind of thing. And right before they were supposed to meet with the Japanese, the individual who had this equipment had since gone back to, I guess it was Phoenix or Tempe, Arizona, where he lived. His home was broken into. All of the data, all of his equipment, everything, you know, like almost $500,000 worth of equipment was stolen. And so they had absolutely no record of what they'd actually seen with their own eyes in terms of the data they collected. So, you know, somebody was obviously very worried about that information getting out. Now, this was all sort of sitting in the back of my mind as I'm, you know, in my little Fiat.
Yeah. When did they do this?
That would have been around 1989, I believe it was.
Okay.
1989 or early 1990. And so around 1991, when I decided that I had to take this Pantera transaxle back east for this rebuild, I decided that I would travel through these areas and see if I couldn't see, kind of a risky proposition to be going on these poorly maintained dirt roads through the mountains of New Mexico in a low slung Fiero.
Yeah.
Ground clearance was a bit of an issue, but I managed to get up on top of the arch.
Oh, you actually made it up there, huh?
Yeah. There's a number of roads that I found on some of the Forestry Service maps. It's at the extreme west end of the town of Dulce, which the main part of the town is just one little street with a few stores on it. It's really not a very exciting town by any means. The thing that was so peculiar about Dulce was that it looks like this little hick town out in the middle of nowhere, except that it's got a multi-million dollar Best Western five-star rated hotel just north of the town up on a hillside just below where the Arch of La Mesa is. Now, there's only one reason I can think of that they'd have a hotel like that in that location, and that is because either there's something in the area that's drawing in tourists. You know, hunting and fishing is certainly one possibility, but the other possibility, of course, is that you have some high-ranking military dignitaries who are coming to visit a complex under Dulce. You know, they may not want to be underground for 5 weeks, you know. They may not want to be down there under the ground with God knows what's happening down there. They might want, you know, some nicer accommodations above ground. And so that was, you know, kind of my thinking.
Boy, would I love to see those motel records. I mean, who checked in, whose charge cards were used.
Oh, yeah, you know, I thought the exact same thing. That's pretty perceptive on your part, because, you know, I had thought, you know, about that exact same thing. And so part of the reason that Paul Shepard and his crew were heading down to Dulce. It was sort of a multi-purpose trip. One of the other things they were doing was they wanted to head down to Albuquerque to a research facility that was operating down there, right outside Kirkland Air Force Base.
I bet you're talking about Sandia Base.
Is that right?
You know, I was almost stationed there in the Army. Last minute, they sent me to the Bay Area in San Francisco. Probably a good thing. I might not be alive today. I mean, I'm pretty inquisitive. And,
well, you know, they do an awful lot of dangerous research there, a lot of advanced high-energy weapons.
I don't think the researchers would have hurt me, but maybe my own troops.
Well, anyway, one of the alternate purposes for going down there was to meet with Paul Benowitz, who at the time claiming that he had had a number of encounters throughout the area and also up near the Archuleta Mesa. So apparently Paul Benowitz had traveled up to the Dulce area, and he'd had a four-wheel drive vehicle, and he traveled a certain distance back into the wilderness somewhere around the Archuleta Mesa, and he'd come up to a rise that overlooked a kind of a canyon, and that according to Paul Shepard, he had witnessed the landing of a craft, your stereotypical saucer-shaped craft, which was met by a number of U.S. military vehicles, and there appeared to be, you know, sort of an open, sort of an operation between some entities that appeared to be non-human and human beings, and they were basically loading some kind of cargo into this craft. He took a number of pictures of this thing, and that he jumped, ran back to his truck, jumped in the truck, ran down into the town of Dulce, went to the local drugstore, and excitedly went to the counter and said, "Do you have 1 hour photo processing?" And the fellow said, "Well, yes, we do." And so he excitedly told this guy behind the counter, "I just saw this UFO, you know, meeting some U.S. military trucks, and they were loading cargo into the UFO." And as he's telling this man behind the counter what he had seen and what he'd photographed, the guy just goes pale as a ghost, and without really turning around, he kind of holds his hand in front of him, and he points behind him over his shoulder in a way that would prevent anything that was behind him from actually seeing this. And Paul Benowitz looks up, and there's a camera up on the wall, and the man points to the camera without actually pointing over his shoulder, and kind of motions with his eyes like, you know, you're being watched. And he tells him, you know, in a very quiet voice, "You need to get out of here right now as fast as you can." And so, you know, Paul took the hint, you know, took the film, ran out to his vehicle, which was kind of a four-wheel drive mobile home kind of thing, like a camper shell on the back of a pickup truck or something. So he takes off, and as he's, you know, maybe 200 yards down the road, he sees a number of vehicles with Air Force, the deep Air Force blue with the yellow Air Force, you know, official Air Force vehicle stenciled on the side, come screeching to a halt. These guys jump out of the car and go running into the store. And so he knows immediately that he's in trouble. As he's just about out of sight, he sees these guys come running back out to the vehicles, and they immediately begin following him. So now he's out in the middle of the wilderness on this road that that travels south from Dulce, going towards, I guess, the central part of the state, back to the main highway system. He's out in the middle of nowhere, and he's really afraid that something awful is going to happen to him. So he decides to sort of take matters into his own hands. He comes around a corner and turns his vehicle so that it basically blocks the highway, jumps out of his vehicle, and he had a 357 Magnum pistol, probably a Smith & Wesson. He basically stood behind his vehicle, and he had this pistol drawn and ready to go as these Air Force vehicles came around the corner. They all stopped, looked at him for a while, talked among themselves, and they basically just turned around and left. So at that point, he felt that, he had some degree of safety, but it wasn't too long after that, after he got back to his office, that the same thing happened to him, that his camera was stolen and he never saw the film again.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's obvious that, you know, something kind of strange is going on there.
Now, what did you see when you got up there?
Well, that was it. That was the thing that was so strange about it, is that when I got there, by the time I arrived in Dulce, this is after spending part of my afternoon near Aztec looking at what I thought was the crash site of this March 25th, 1948 crash. By the time I got to Dulce, it was nightfall. And so I had a map of the town. I knew where Paul Shepard and some of his crew had gone to get up on top of the Archuleta Mesa. And it was a little dirt road that sort of proceeded north, crossed over a rickety wooden bridge across the stream that runs a little bit to the west and to the north of Dulce, and started up this mountain road. And I got up onto the top of the mesa. There's a little bit of snow on the ground. It was extremely cold out. I had a sleeping bag, and I really couldn't see any evidence that there was any kind of a military operation going on there. Now remember, this is like February or March, so it's still pretty much winter time.
Yeah.
Very, very cold up there. And so the likelihood of your encountering any kind of bugs, any kind of flying insects, is near zero, especially at, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning. So I found a clearing, and I pulled the Fierro off the road, got my long johns on, put my sleeping bag out on the ground with sort of an insulator pad to kind of keep me warm. And I'm laying there on the ground. I can't see anything, but there is something flying all around me. There's at least three objects, and I don't know what they are, but all I can tell you is that if you've ever had a mosquito kind of fly up and land near your ear, that really high-pitched buzzing sound that you hear, that's the sound that I'm hearing hovering and moving all around me while I'm laying there on the ground. It was the spookiest thing you can imagine, because I could not see a thing. Perfectly clear night, moonless night, beautiful star. I mean, more stars than you can imagine, because there's no light pollution or anything from Dulce. And yet, you know, I mean, I even took a swat, you know, at the open air around me when I thought one of these things came close to me. And I just caught air, nothing else. But I had the distinct feeling that there was some kind of several objects that were hovering around me. And it was really kind of an unnerving experience. And when I would get into the car and roll up the windows, you wouldn't hear it. So it was obviously something in the environment, something that was unseen. But at the same time, it was, you know, something that was obviously paying attention to my presence there. And at one point, a large truck went rumbling by on the roadway. I couldn't really determine whether it was, a civilian truck with, some of the local rednecks out, you know, poking around in the middle of the night, or whether it was a military vehicle. It was just simply too dark. But, I was there for probably 2 hours, and it became more than I can really tolerate.
So you had to get up and get out of it.
Yeah. In fact, I thought about just sitting in the car and watching the sky, but it was just so bone-chilling cold that I basically jumped in the car and I left Dulce.
Okay, Mark, I appreciate you taking time to talk to me today about all of this. Incredible stories. In finishing this, let's wrap it up by, first of all, Aztec. You went to the crash site. You think something probably happened there, right?
It certainly looked like there had been some activity there. Like I say, this large block of cement that looked as though it had either been used to cover something up or been used as a foundation for some kind of a crane or some kind of a physical support for moving components during the disassembly of this craft and the transport, on back roads up to military installation to be transported off to Wright-Patterson. Yeah, so it looked like something had happened there quite a long time ago.
And poking around Area 51, the only thing that was bad that happened to you is you got some speeding ticket.
Yes.
And on top of Archuleta Mesa, in Dulce, you had these strange insect noises, even though it was freezing cold. And you got the hell out of there.
It's, like 25 degrees, and it's middle of the night, way too cold. I mean, insects, anything below about 45 degrees, and they just almost go completely dormant. They don't fly, they just sit there. And, but, you know, there was obviously something moving above ground in the air around me, something I could not see, but I could clearly hear it. I mean, you know, and it wasn't just sort of a generalized buzzing sound in the area that was inexplicable. It was actually like there was a point source from the sound. You could actually hear that it was a unique point of emanation for the sound moving around me. Obviously not close enough for me to actually reach out and touch, but loud enough that I could hear it. And it was just an extremely high frequency, like the sound of mosquito wings when something's, you know, something like that's coming up to land.
Cold night like that, did you look around for some vents?
Vents?
Yeah, I mean, warm air coming out from the ground. I've always heard reports of vents up there.
No, in fact, I did look for things like that, and I didn't see anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
Not a thing.
Mark McCandlish, it was a great show. Thanks for being on. We'll do it again.
Okay, Jerry. Appreciate
it. I'm Jerry Pippin. Our web producer is Jane Swartley. Until next time, thank you for listening. Cheers.